You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of September 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Marco Sippi, and Victoria Graham.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute will set today's agenda. Raffaello, what do you have for us today?
Well, today we're going to talk about the terrible events in Nairobi. We're going to talk about the fact that the UN General Assembly starts off. And we're going to talk about the fact that Facebook is going to be opening in China.
Plus, the killing of two Israeli soldiers by Palestinians in the West Bank jeopardizes the ongoing peace talks again. We'll be on the line with our Jerusalem correspondent to discuss the latest developments in the region.
And Liam Aldous, our correspondent in Spain, will tell us why the Spanish king almost resigned. At least everyone thought he would, and he'll give us the latest from the San Sebastian Film Festival he's currently attending.
Also ahead, we kickstart our preview of Monocle Magazine's retail special and visit a tea room in New York that has decided to adopt the city's cafe culture.
A lot of customers will walk by, look at our wall display, be intrigued by it, and read our signs that we have outside, and then come in to see that it's a full tea cafe, and there's no coffee here.
All that, plus we'll tell you about storytelling in Ethiopia, and we'll even play you some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Paul Osborne.
Authorities in Kenya say all hostages have now been freed from a shopping mall in Nairobi, ending a three-day siege by Islamist militants. But explosions and gunfire were heard at dawn, despite officials saying the terrorists had been defeated. 62 people are believed to have died, with more than 170 others injured. Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto praised the operation against the terrorists.
Their commitment to evil has robbed their hearts of the merest suggestion of human consideration. That does not mean that they are impregnable. As we have just demonstrated, terrorism can and must be fought mercilessly and defeated wherever it occurs.
The Somali Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab says it carried out the attack in revenge for Kenya's military operations inside Somalia. Monocle's Tristan McConnell, who's in Nairobi, says there are now fears Somalis in Kenya could face retribution.
Somali communities in Kenya have suffered both at the hands of the police forces and at the hands of angry civilians when we've had things like grenade attacks.
The White House has confirmed the U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry, is to meet Iran's foreign minister in the next few days. It follows comments from Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, who said last week that Iran had no intention of developing nuclear weapons. Mr. Rouhani is due in New York next week, where he'll speak at the UN General Assembly on the same day as President Obama. A former FBI agent is facing 11 years in jail for leaking information about an al-Qaeda plot to carry out attacks in Yemen. Officials say Donald Sachleben put an international intelligence operation in jeopardy when he revealed details of the plot to the Associated Press. He was identified after journalists' phone records were seized, a move which led to criticism of US authorities. The parliament in Cambodia has approved a new five-year term for the country's long-serving prime minister. Hun Sen has been in power since 1985, but the country's opposition is boycotting the parliamentary session. It continues to demand an investigation into allegations of ballot rigging in July's election. Authorities in Mexico say an attack in which 10 people died may have been in revenge for a kidnapping 2 months earlier. A 7-year-old girl was among the victims of the shooting in the town of Luna Blanca. Two gunmen attacked a house where around 30 people were at a party. The legendary American singer Stevie Wonder has addressed the United Nations. He was speaking at a debate on help for people with disabilities. The singer said world leaders must work together to help the most vulnerable.
We need to make sure that real participation in voices of persons
with disabilities are included in everything we do for peace and development around the world.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. It's 5 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Time now to set the day's news agenda with the stories you need to know. Raffaella Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, joins us now in the studio. Hello, Raffaella. Good morning.
Good morning.
At least 62 have been killed and more than 170 injured in an attack in Westgate Mall in Nairobi. What is your take on that? That's the story you want to start with today.
Well, I think it's clearly the story that's going to dominate the news agenda today. I mean, it's been dominating for the past few days. We've seen it building up. It's ever since this group of Al-Shabaab-linked terrorists took over this mall in the middle of downtown Nairobi. They sort of seemed to take over this space. They killed a bunch of people and they've been holding on to it. And we've seen ever since then, the Kenyan government's been saying every day that they managed to push them out, they managed to get rid of them. But this morning we're still having reports that the problem's still ongoing. This, I think, is a very substantial terrorist incident. I think it's one that's going to refocus attention on the Horn of Africa. We've sort of been talking a lot about terrorism in Africa in the past year as something that's been growing. We can think back to January with the incident at In Amenas over in Algeria, where a group took over an oil installation there. I think that this is clearly quite a significant incident. I think the element that's being highlighted today, which is seeming to get a lot of attention, is the potential presence of Westerners amongst the attackers.
So what kind of consequences are you waiting to see in the Horn of Africa after this?
Well, I mean, to be perfectly honest, I think the ultimate end result of this is probably going to be very similar to that which we saw after the In Amenas incident in Algeria, which is there was a spike in attention and there was a sense in the West of, oh, maybe we need to pay more attention to these sorts of hotspots around the world that we've slightly started to look away from. But at the same time, fundamentally, very little will change. The United Kingdom, for example, already does a great deal in counter-terrorism and countering violent extremism in the Horn of Africa. And I imagine they will just sort of refocus these efforts even more. But I think broadly speaking, we're not going to see any major changes.
Raffaella, you mentioned just earlier about the possible Western influence here. Mm. We're talking about the White Widow and saying that since she went over there, she's gained a sort of semi-mythical status, hasn't she? What do we know more about that?
Well, I mean, Samantha Luthwaite, this mythical White Widow figure, was the wife of one of the 7/7 bombers who struck here in London. She was part of that whole sort of community around around that plot. And then she sort of disappeared. And then she's now reemerged about a couple of years ago as part of some investigations out in East Africa. There was a suspicion she was involved in these things, but then, you know, she just sort of evaporated into the mists. Now she's being quoted as being maybe part of this plot. It's actually very uncertain if we know this for sure. We've got very conflicting reports with the Kenyan Interior Minister saying that there was no women involved, and then yesterday the Kenyan Foreign Minister making a statement in which he said that a woman was involved of British origin. So it's a very mixed picture. I mean, the thing about Samantha Luthwaite is because of her personal narrative. It's because she's a very sort of compelling figure. You know, it's a sort of very tidy, this nice girl from the home counties here in the UK, converts to Islam.
Originally from Aylesbury, wasn't she?
Exactly. You know, and she marries this guy who becomes this important terrorist here, and she runs off and becomes this figure involved in this whole network in East Africa. I mean, you know, this is a very sort of cinematic tale. Mm. So I can see why it's very compelling. However, I think the tangible evidence of whether she was involved in this particular incident remains to be proven.
Exactly. Well, moving on to your second story, President Barack Obama kicks off the 68th session of the UN General Assembly today. What are you expecting to see there?
Well, I mean, this has a lot more potential in many ways. I mean, this is a story where we're seeing the UNGA is a sort of big annual event that happens where all the world leaders get together. And so what you have is you have an opportunity where leaders who usually can't talk to each other because of bilateral issues, they're in a forum which is sort of international. And so they can sort of bump into each other, if you will. And so the big thing that everyone's looking out for, well, there's really two big stories on the table, and they're interlinked in some ways. One is Iran and sort of Iran being seemingly brought in from the cold. We've had the Iranian foreign minister who's had very successful apparent meetings with the Japanese foreign minister, the British foreign minister, and Catherine Ashton, the EU's high representative for foreign policy. And it looks like he's going to have a meeting with John Kerry, which is a very significant and senior thing. We haven't seen these meetings happen in a while. And then the real question is Barack Obama and Mr. Rouhani, the new Iranian prime minister, are they going to bump into each other at some point and maybe exchange words?
Can you paint us a picture if that is going to happen on one of the corridors at the UN? What do they say to each other, and are there any protocols?
Well, I think it's the protocol is that people know that everything is being watched. So I think they're very careful about this sort of phrasing. We have I think if I read correctly, the last sort of official encounter of this sort that we saw was Condoleezza Rice with her Iranian counterpart a few years ago, and apparently they literally bumped into each other, said, you know, hello, nice to see you, and then walk their separate ways. So it's perfectly possible we'll see that again here. But, you know, we're seeing that President Rouhani, or Prime Minister Rouhani, has definitely been pushing forwards a more positive agenda. He had this opinion editorial in the Washington Post last week that, you know, painted a picture of a country that seems to want to try to come out from the cold. These meetings with the foreign minister went very well. You know, maybe we're going to start to see something of a breakthrough here.
Do you actually wait something actual to happen when it comes to Rouhani and his attitude? Or do you think there's still a chance that that's just cosmetic?
I think, you know, the proof is in the pudding, right? We have to see something actually take place and see some sort of change. I mean, I think all the signs are positive, but, you know, we had positive signs before with other leaderships when they change. And it's very easy to read these sort of diplomatic tea leaves and then see that fundamentally very little has actually changed. But, you know, I think that the general sense within Iran was that Ahmadinejad and the sort of very hard line he'd been advancing wasn't necessarily something that the leadership in the mullahs really wanted in Iran. And so it's possible that Rouhani, with this sort of more, I don't know, open message that he seems to be advancing, might be the real deal. We certainly saw apparently that they released 80 political prisoners just before he came, which is, you know, a clear political signal of some sort of opening up.
This could be the most significant meeting for decades then, I suppose.
It could potentially. I mean, I think it's always very dangerous to say that this is going to be a sort of dramatic turning point and as of tomorrow, everything will be different. But, you know, I think this is clearly, it's a slow process. All the steps are positive so far. I think, you know, we should look at this with an open mind.
Okay, well, should we move on? And yes. Facebook opening in China.
Yes, well, this is, you know, for anyone who's lived in China, this is potentially great news, especially if you lived in Shanghai like me. They've been talking for a while about opening the Shanghai Free Trade Zone. This is something that's been advanced by the Prime Minister or Premier Li Keqiang. And the aim is to create a sort of space within Shanghai which is more open to foreign companies and to try to turn the city into a real international sort of economic hub. And part of this, it turns out, is that they're going to turn off the great Chinese firewall in this site so people can actually access stuff like Facebook, YouTube.
This will be
Twitter.
Welcomed, won't it, by many people?
Oh, yes. I mean, this is going to be the deal breaker.
Do you know what the Chinese government is actually thinking about when they're doing this? What's the reason? Are they trying to make the area just simply more attractive for foreign companies?
I think that's a big part of it. I think that there must be a realization that, you know, if you're going to look at, if you're going to be an international company, you want to attract international companies to come there and set up business, they have to be able to access the internet and they have to be able to access information on a sort of real-time basis. They can't expect to have virtual private networks, which is what foreigners usually have to use there if you're using if you're trying to access sort of sites like Twitter or Facebook, you know, which are very slow and take time, you have to just have unfettered access. And so, you know, for companies, I'm sure that they would look at the country and say, well, you know, how do we know that plug's not suddenly going to get pulled on our capacity to communicate with the world?
What is interesting about this story is that it's not just social media, it's also some specific websites such as the New York Times that is going to be available over there as well. Yeah. When it comes to freedom of speech, how well do you think the Chinese government is going to be able to contain that in one specific area?
Well, I mean, the freedom of speech, I think in some ways that question is one that the Chinese government has tackled and worried about a long time ago and has already sort of happened. I mean, the internet is so open there in many ways. You've got Weibo and other things. There's sort of online conversation, which is incredibly sophisticated and incredibly sort of detailed and in many ways reflects what we would probably see as a free speech environment. However, the point is that the government does still have restrictions and certain hard lines. The New York Times is a very good example. The New York Times wrote a substantial article about Premier Wen Jiabao and his family's financial ties. After this, the site got blocked. You know, and so these sorts of things, it raises questions. What kind of a country are you running if when you have some critical media appear about the leadership, suddenly the media gets shut down? That's not really a sort of open and free society. So it is a complex question. Because on the other hand, if you look at Weibo, some of the conversations they have there about, for example, the recent jailing of Bo Xilai, it was, you know, people were complaining. People were saying this is just, this is unjust. It was a real sort of conversation going on. So I think it's a very dynamic situation. And it's interesting the government's obviously recognised that this is important if they want to really internationalise.
Thank you very much for that, Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute.
Still to come, we find out why King Juan Carlos of Spain had everyone believing he would abdicate. But first we head to the West Bank, where Israel-Palestine peace talks are once again in jeopardy.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sippi, and Victoria Graham. It is 16:17 in Tokyo, 8:17 in London, 17 minutes past midnight in San Francisco. Since John Kerry announced the resumption of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks some months ago, few on both sides have taken them seriously. But the peace process has continued, albeit overshadowed by news from Syria. Then over the weekend, two Israeli soldiers were killed by Palestinians in the West Bank, promoting right-wing voices in Israel to call for an end of peace negotiations.
Playing to his hardline political base, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called for the immediate resettlement of a controversial settler building in Hebron after the latest attacks. So has this round of Israeli-Palestinian talks played its course, and are we headed to a sustained outbreak of violence on the West Bank? Well, joining us on the line from Tel Aviv is Monocle's Jerusalem correspondent Joseph Danner to shed some light on the matter. Good morning, Joseph. Hebron seems to be a real catalyst for violence at the moment.
Absolutely. And traditionally, Hebron has been one of those real sticking points in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. One could argue that it's almost as contested as Jerusalem. And so you have about 450, maybe even 1,000 Israeli settlers that live in the center of one of the most built-up Palestinian urban areas on the West Bank. And over the weekend, a Palestinian sniper who hasn't been caught yet basically shot and killed an Israeli soldier that was protecting a number of Jewish worshippers at the Cave of the Patriarchs, which is a very holy site for both Jews and Muslims. And so this has really kicked off a kind of cycle of events in Israel and Palestine, which very well might derail the peace process. We're seeing how it's unfolding basically up to the minute.
And indeed, after those killings, there was an instant reaction from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who called for the immediate resettlement of a controversial settler building in Hebron after the attacks. How big is the symbolic value of this gesture?
Well, Netanyahu has a kind of track record of doing these kind of things during his prime ministership. But back in 1996, in the kind of heydays of the Oslo Peace Accords, he authorized the opening of a tunnel which would connect the Arab quarter of the Old City to the Western Wall, the holiest site in Judaism, and that sparked a lot of riots and many people died as a result. And so his reaction to allow settlers to take over yet another very controversial building in the center of Hebron within 24 hours of this killing is very indicative of the fact that he's talking to his hardline base, basically in the Israeli in Israeli society, and is willing to kind of make these very verbose gestures that are basically an affront to the peace process. And so we've seen condemnations of this resettlement of the building from the Palestinians, of course. And the Americans are a bit on the fence. They've condemned the killing, but they realize that this peace process that John Kerry has worked so hard for is very much in the balance. It could just fall away, you know, in the coming weeks.
Is Hebron still in lockdown?
Hebron, from what I understand, Hebron is still in lockdown. And, you know, the Israeli army is very adept at just taking over this massive city. It's hard to kind of, you know, relay exactly how it feels. But this is a very built-up urban area, and a military is basically taking it over, and people can't go out to the market, they can't go to school, you know, they can't get to hospital and things like that as the army kind of sweeps the area looking for this sniper. And that will probably continue. And also, as a result of that, the Israeli settlers that live in the area kind of attack Palestinians and Palestinian merchandise and whatnot. So it's really a messy situation, but it's not necessarily one that people didn't see coming.
So, Joseph, where are we at the moment? What's happening with the peace process?
Well, I think, as we noted in the introduction, the peace process kind of limped into existence. You know, John Kerry made a very noble effort, a lot of boots on the ground, as it were, to get these talks started. But no one on the Israeli-Palestinian, or on the Israeli or the Palestinian side, really invested that much effort thinking that this was going to solve the conflict. And the situation in Syria has very much provided a media diversion for both Israeli and Palestinian leaders. And now Netanyahu is headed to the United Nations to give a speech probably about Iran, and we're going to see that standard Israeli line about how Iran is the real menace in the region. And so we're going to see a continued diversion from the Israeli-Palestinian talks while this violence continues to kind of manifest itself on the West Bank. And so it doesn't look good.
Do you think there's anything that can be done to prevent from things getting any worse?
Well, it's an excellent question. I think that's on the minds of many Israeli and Palestinian civilians as to, you know, whether or not there's anything civil society can do to kind of, you know, apply some sort of leverage on the leadership of both parties. And right now, I don't know if that's really the case. I think that the Syrian and the Iranian situation is really going to dominate the headlines, at least in Israel, and it will allow the Israelis a certain amount of cover to continue entrenching the settlements on the West Bank and entrenching its control over Palestinian life on the West Bank. And so I don't see any way that that's really avoidable in the next at least coming months or anything like that. And so we can expect more of the same status quo, as it were.
Thank you very much. That was Joseph Dane, our Jerusalem correspondent, speaking to us from Tel Aviv.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 17:23 in Sydney, 11:23 in Moscow and 9:23 in San Sebastian. And that's where we're heading next. Monocle's correspondent Liam Alders joins us now on the line for the latest discussions topics from Spain. Hello, Liam. Good morning.
Good morning to both of you from San Sebastian.
Now tell us, there's been rumours about King Juan Carlos and his abdication, but are they true?
No, I actually have to admit that I jumped the gun a little on Friday when the rumor mill was going into overdrive, and that was because the Spanish Royal Palace had announced a press conference, and I emailed Midori House saying that the king was going to abdicate. Everyone was talking about it, but then when the press conference started, it actually was announced that he was going to have another operation. So all the people hoping that the king would abdicate and his young, sprightly son would take over. All their hopes were quashed. So this is actually going to be the fifth operation for the ailing king in 18 months. He's actually got an infected pelvis after he had a hip replacement. So all eyes will be on him today when he actually goes under the knife today, later today.
So the reason why so many people thought that he would actually abdicate is that this kind of press conferences are extremely rare and they have never taken place before any other operations that the king has had. Do you think, does the king have new press officers? Are they applying new communication strategies? Or what was the reason for this press conference?
Well, I think it's the Royal Palace is a little bit under pressure at the moment. There's a lot of scandals, so I think they just wanted and there's a lot of talk, about abdication. So I think they wanted to quash any rumours that the king, even though his health is failing, he has had a few health scares lately as well. He was at an event, the opening of the judicial calendar ceremony, only a week ago, and he really kind of stumbled on his words, and someone had to take the microphone away from him. So there's been a lot of talk about abdication, but they really wanted to come out fighting and really present this image that he's actually in good spirits and he's not going to abdicate. He wants to really ensure that his legacy is not damaged, because he's had so many problems recently. I think he's being a little stubborn and wants to make sure his image improves before he steps down.
Yes, some were hoping for a breath of fresh air, weren't they? So what can he do to improve his image at this time?
Well, there have been a few little efforts he's been trying to push, but they've kind of been eclipsed by these health scares. So there was talk of really leading a pact to improve youth unemployment in the country. But that, once again, was eclipsed by his health scares and the fact that his daughter and son-in-law have had are involved in a huge corruption trial at the moment. So it seems that every kind of step forward he takes, he kind of stumbles backwards, and the scandals are just consuming him.
Liam, I think you should explain the next story by yourself. Spanish Congress has been experiencing a sort of a scandal over bullet holes.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that not many people would think that Congress would want to preserve bullet holes in the ceiling. But in Spain, there was actually a failed coup attempt in 1981, and some shots were fired in the parliament. The kind of siege lasted a day, and they've preserved these bullet holes as a reminder of the fragility of democracy and how close they came to actually falling under military dictatorship again. So only 12 days ago, there was a huge rainstorm in Madrid, kind of uncharacteristic for the summer. And there's been some construction going on in the Congress over the last 2 months. A lot of rumors were saying that it was actually because the government wanted to really construct some, or put up some scaffolding around the Congress to prevent protesters from storming the Congress, as they've tried to do quite a few times. But it seems they actually were doing something up there, because there were a lot of holes left on the roof. So the first session of Congress this year, or after the summer, actually led to the Congress being flooded. So everyone had to run out of the Congress and abandon the first session. But in the cleanup, I was scrambling to clean up. I actually could see from my house, or from my kitchen window, I can see the Congress roof, and they were welding up in the middle of the rain. But they actually patched up the bullet holes, and there's been a little bit of outrage saying that the government's tried to patch up or cover up a really dark moment in history. But it just turns out there's been an inquiry has been held, and it turns out it was just shoddy building practices.
Do you think there's any way of restoring bullet holes?
Well, I can think of one way, but I don't think that would be
Let's move on. Let's move on to the San Sebastian Film Festival, which sounds great fun. There must be a real buzz there at the moment.
It is. It's one of the most exciting times of the year here in San Sebastian. The weather's been great as well. It's no rain. It rains quite a lot here in the Basque Country, but it's going to be 30 degrees every day, and the sun is shining brightly. But there's a lot of movies, and there's a lot of international film stars and directors running around for a small town on the northern coast. It's quite unusual. I actually saw Alfonso Cuarón's movie Gravity, which has a lot of buzz around it yesterday, and attended the press conference with him and his son. He was there. It's a great film, actually. I recommend it when it comes out.
Any other highlights you want to mention?
Well, I wasn't really looking forward to a Spanish film called Cannibal, about a tailor / cannibal who lives in Granada. There's a lot of buzz around that film as well, but I saw it last night, and I was quite underwhelmed. I was really disappointed.
Tailor, cannibal, bullets and bad builders. I think we've had it all. Thank you very much, Liam Aldous from Spain, our correspondent, San Sebastian. Stay with us here on Midori House, because in the next half hour of the programme, we'll leaf through the Brazilian front pages, we'll discuss storytelling in the Horn of Africa, and we'll pop by a tea shop that thinks it's a cafe.
The interior design is a critical component of a cafe. Ambiance, how warm it is, how inviting it can be, really helps us pull more customers in.
But first, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
Authorities in Kenya say that all the hostages have now been freed from a shopping mall in Nairobi, ending a three-day siege by Islamist militants. But explosions and gunfire were heard at dawn, and it's thought a small number of attackers remain inside the shopping centre. 62 people are believed to have died, and more than 170 others were injured. The White House has confirmed that the US Secretary of State John Kerry will meet Iran's foreign minister in the next few days. It's after comments from Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, who said last week that Iran had no intention of developing nuclear weapons. A former FBI agent could be jailed for 11 years for leaking information about an al-Qaeda plot to carry out attacks in Yemen. Officials say Donald Sakleben put an international intelligence operation in jeopardy when he revealed details of the plot to the Associated Press. The authorities in Mexico say an attack in which 10 people died may have been in revenge for a kidnapping 2 months earlier. A 7-year-old girl was among the victims of the shooting in the town of Luna Blanca. Two gunmen attacked a house where a party was taking place. And Cambodia's parliament's approved a new 5-year term for the country's long-serving Prime Minister Hun Sen. He's been in power since 1985, but the country's opposition continues to demand an investigation into allegations of ballot rigging in the election, which was held in July. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
It's 10:31 in Istanbul, 8:31 in London, and 3:31 in New York City. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Victoria Graham, and Marcus Hippie. Now, for the rest of the week, we'll be previewing Monocle magazine's retail special in the October issue. If you don't have it, then you should. And today we head to New York, where one tea shop is adopting and adapting the Big Apple's cafe culture.
Press Tea is located in the heart of the West Village and specialises in tea shots instead of espresso ones. Monocle's Tristan McAllister popped in to meet the two owners of Press Tea, Richard Chen and George Kwan.
I look at this store from the street, and it's fairly unassuming. I mean, there's nothing really loud outside. What do you think pulls people in here? How does the experience start for people coming off the street?
I believe that the decor and outside display has helped us in regards to attraction. A lot of customers would walk by, look at our wall display, be intrigued by it, and read our signs that we have outside, and then come in to see that it's a full tea cafe, and there's no coffee here. I feel like the decor that we've built has a great impact on defining who we are and representing ourselves as a brand and as a company. The interior design is a critical component of a cafe. Ambiance, how warm it is, how inviting it can be, really helps us pull more customers in, strictly on the facade of the entire structure of the building.
I'm sitting in here looking around. I'm sitting in actually a nice chair, and we're at a wooden table, and there's a lot of texture to the space. And it's not like your typical tea room. And this isn't really a tea room, is it?
No, it's not a typical tea room. We did not go into this business thinking that we wanted to build a typical tea room. Our interior designer, Karen Olson, helped us design this entire place. We want to convey a message of sophistication, opulence, someone that comes in and feels homely at the same time. She is one of the top leading designers for Saks Fifth Avenue and Bloomingdale's, and she's a family friend. And she came up with this concept, and we gave her a description of what we want based on the type of image we want to display. And typically with our customer base here, they're more affluent, they have a college degree, and these are type of people we want to cater to.
In talking about your product, I think moving beyond just the experience when you walk in the door, what is different about the product that you're offering? Explain to me what Press Tea is.
The tea in America, from my point of view, has always been a little bit more diluted in general. There are tea purveyors out there that do a good job of making teas, but since Richard and I come from our Asian background and we would visit our home roots in Taiwan, there is a big disparity in the taste between the tea in Asia and a tea in America. I feel like our products is much more in line. It has more flavor. It's more robust. It's bolder. It's richer too. And we wanted a product that was much more in line with coffee, taste-wise, as opposed to just a regular tea bag and then water. That's not what we want to do. So taste, flavor, body, and just the experience of drinking it, understanding what our definition of gourmet tea is different from someone else's definition of gourmet tea in America.
So I see in here there, in some ways it's like a tea shop in a coffee shop's clothing, because you have drinks on the menu that are akin to what you'd find in a coffee shop, but there's no coffee to be found. So explain to me the menu and how people are struck by it, because it is sort of an unorthodox way of looking at tea, right?
Yes, it is. And this is why we're making the products the way we make it and how we differentiate ourselves from everybody else. When you look at a product such as tea, there's a lack of understanding of how to make it unique. Most people would think tea equates to boring. Tea bag, water, done. That's it. How we're making it is introducing a whole new flavor profile, infusing it with milk, infusing it with as a latte, as a cappuccino, as a macchiato, that can be made just like coffee, in the sense that it's also just as rich as coffee too. And also not just the hot drinks, but our cold drinks too, infused with different purees. When you have fruit flavors infused with tea, it can actually enhance the flavor of the tea itself. We also have a product that's called the Mont Blanc Creme that we put on top of our teas. It's a little bit salty, it's a little bit sweet, and anyone that's in the culinary field would understand that if you have a little bit of salt and a little bit of sweetness on any type of food, it enhances the flavor and the taste of the food itself and brings it out even more. So these are all very innovative ideas and concepts and products that we've brought out to the public. And our feedback from everybody that's tried it has been phenomenal, to say the least. So that's how we differentiate ourselves. And it's not just the product itself, it's also the process too, how we make it. When we press this product, there's more tannins, okay? There's more antioxidants, quicker too. And no one's making it like we are. We're the first ones to do it here in America, and we're the first ones that want to differentiate how our product is different from other tea purveyors through the process, through the product itself, and through innovation. These three things tie into why our products, how we feel, is different from everybody else's.
So what's the hope beyond this? I mean, you know, I heard him the other day talking about taking this other places. Is that the hope?
Yes, our goal is to eventually obviously expand within Manhattan to the outer boroughs, tri-state area, then nationally to different cities, and then from there, globally. That's the whole goal and the whole point of doing this. For us, it's like literally one cup at a time. We want to make sure our customers are happy. We want to make sure our community has a sense of identity with tea, so they come in here. And it's just to build a business that kind of encompasses the environment too. The city, the people, the culture here. And to define this as something that came out of America, because it did start in New York City, and this is a New York City product. You know, I'm a native New Yorker, and I'm very proud of the product that we have, and customers are saying the same exact thing.
That was the owners of Prestige, Richard Chen and George Guan, speaking to Tristan McAllister.
You're listening to Midori House. After this break, we'll explore Ethiopian storytelling and we'll review the Brazilian newspapers.
Aperitivo is the latest addition to the Monocle 24 lineup. Airing every weekday at 1800 hours London time, Aperitivo is the perfect way to digest the day's biggest stories. From our studios at Midori House and over a flat white with special guests at the Monocle Cafe, we'll feature a relaxed blend of conversation and analysis that you simply won't hear anywhere else. That's Aperitivo, airing every weekday at 1800 hours London time. Brought to you in association with the Glenlivet.
/24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches, and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists, and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 16:40 in Tokyo and 8:40 here in London. And now it's time for a story. In fact, many stories, and one woman's mission to collect them for fear of losing them forever. Prize-winning children's author Elizabeth Laird embarked on a journey across Ethiopia to document the folk tales of people she encountered.
Her book, The Lure of the Honeybird, is a collection of tales gathered on a thrilling journey around Ethiopia. The collection includes everything from the weird and wonderful to the magical, and we're joined live in the studio by her now. Welcome to the programme. Could you tell us about the background? What made you intrigued by Ethiopian storytelling in the first place?
I'd lived in Ethiopia back in the 1960s when I was teaching there, and I'd very much wanted to go back. And I was there in 1996, just enjoying the countryside, walking along a hillside, when I bumped into an old man. Actually, I was looking at a groove in the ground where a line of ants with their tiny feet had made a sort of motorway in the earth. And I saw this pair of horned feet on the other side of the groove, and I looked up and it was an old farmer, and he said, "Have you lost something of value? Are you looking for it?" And I said, "No, I'm looking at the ants." He said, "I will tell you a very good story about the ant. It is a very good animal." He told me a wonderful story. Do you know, I decided I'd rushed back to Addis Ababa, I'd write it down. When I got there, I'd completely forgotten the story, which is infuriating. That evening, I happened to be talking to the director of the British Council in Ethiopia, and I said, "Look, I've had a brainwave. I want you to give me a translator and a Land Rover. I'll go around to a few places, collect some folk stories, and I'll write readers in simplified English so that Ethiopian children can practice their reading while listening to, while using their own cultural material." He said, "What a good idea, but I don't want you to do a few stories. I want you to write 24 little books, and I want you to take many journeys around the whole of Ethiopia." So I came back 5 times and did long journeys to every corner of that wonderful country.
It's an amazing idea, and one that sort of makes me quite nostalgic, really, because we have lost the art of storytelling. Oh, yes. The thought of stopping in the street and just talking to somebody is almost bizarre, isn't it, these days?
It's absolutely true. Of course, there has to be a special occasion when you'll tell a story in Ethiopia, and they're not for children, these stories. They're for grown-ups, absolutely. I mean, you know, you set out the... Sometimes we all got a bit merry on Honeymead. Sometimes I'd set out a coffee ceremony, and people would embark on their stories. Sometimes the fumes of incense in the little house would be so heavy I'd have to go out coughing and choking.
Were there any specific themes that were reoccurring in Ethiopia?
Oh, God, I mean, tell me about it. There was, you could have the Aesop-type fables about animals that were sort of moralistic stories to teach people how to be good. You had the weird and wonderful djinns, wizards, witches, the porcupine man, one of my very favourites. You had, the demon of the spring who catches gulls when they go to collect water. Very scary. You've got the sort of origin myths of people, of their own people, which amazingly link with the Old Testament.
Am I right in my impression that many of these stories actually have lessons to teach people?
Yes, some of them do. Some of them are obviously educational, you know, how to behave well and how you learn to trust people or not trust people and how you treat old people or you're kind or whatever. Lovely story about the best, I can tell you millions of them, but and some of them are very profound, almost Sufi stories.
And how are you received over there when you're wandering around Ethiopia on this huge journey? I mean, how do people take to you? Did they think it was odd, bizarre that you're out there, or did they quite freely talk to you?
You can't just wander about Ethiopia asking people to tell you stories. I'd set up the project very carefully with the Ministry of Education in Addis Ababa. And so everywhere I went, I was an official guest, and the local education officer and cultural officer would look after me and assemble the storytellers. You couldn't do it unless you had proper official backing. Ethiopians are jolly good like that. They know perfectly well that their country is the target of do-gooders, evangelical Christian missionaries, Islamic fundamentalist missionaries, and they just don't want all that. So they keep, very sensibly, quite a tight rein on who's running around the country.
And you came across some pretty tricky situations at times, didn't you? Yes. Were you ever afraid?
Pretty terrified. Mm. I mean, the road to down to the Somali region was the day before a bus had been hijacked and all the people on it had been shot by the bandits. So it was scary, sometimes, yeah.
But that didn't put you off carrying on your journey and collecting these stories?
Look, I mean, if you're on the trail of a story, you know what it's like.
You're a news hound, aren't you? You want to know everything.
We've been talking about this story so much, I'd really like to hear some of your favourite stories, so just one even, if you can pick one.
Okay. This is a jolly nice story. I think this is a very funny one, actually. It's from the Afar region of northeast Ethiopia. And this is an area which is one of the harshest places to live you can imagine in the whole world. In fact, on the way down there, the driver had offered to sell me to somebody there. And he'd looked at me, this guy, hard as nails, lived in the hottest place on earth, skinny, tough. He looked at me and he said, she wouldn't last a week out here. That was the end of my career as an Afar wife. Anyway, so in this story, the Afar people were nomadic and they lived in little round basket type houses, which they put on their camels, they could dismantle and carry. In this story, a young man falls in love with a very, very beautiful Afar girl, and he has to marry her. He's rich. He goes to her father, and her father says, well, what will you give me if I give you my daughter? And the man says, everything I've got, all my cattle, my camels, my horses, everything you can have. The father says, okay, I'll take the lot. So they get married. But now they have nothing to live on. He has nothing left. So he says, never mind, I'm a very good hunter. And every day I'll go out and kill something and that's what we'll eat. So every day he goes out and he comes back later in the evening with something to eat. And so they live. And then one day her father comes to visit. And she's terribly upset. She has nothing to give him. The pot is empty. Her husband's out hunting. The first rule of life in the Afar culture is you must be hospitable to your guest. Whatever happens, you must feed them and so on. She has nothing to give him. She's getting frantic. She lights the fire to cook the meat when her husband comes back. He doesn't come. She's going mad. Finally, she hears footsteps outside the hut. She rushes out. Another man is passing by. He has a dead bushbuck over his shoulder. She says, oh, please, can you give me a leg of your bushbuck? Because I have a guest and I can't feed him. And then when my husband comes home, he'll give you whatever he's killed. The guy looks her up and down. He says, well, I don't want anything from your husband, but you're an extremely pretty girl. And what I really want is to meet you later on in the dark. So she, what can she do? She's in a cleft stick. This is a very traditional society. She'll be, you know, I mean, we're talking about dangerous stuff here. But her father's waiting to be fed. Finally, she says, oh, all right then, just give me a leg of the bushbuck. So he gives her a leg of the bushbuck. She cooks it and she's feeding her father when her husband comes home and he's killed a zebra. They have a fabulous feast of meat that night on the zebra. Delicious, actually. It's wonderful stuff. And then she hears a pebble rattling on the roof of the hut. She does nothing. She hears another pebble rattling on the roof of the hut. She smiles. She hears a third pebble rattling on the roof of the hut. She bursts out laughing. Her husband and her father say to her, what's the matter with you? She says, I'm laughing at three fools. The first is my husband, who gave away everything he had for me so that, he's poor. The second is my father, who took all his son-in-law's wealth so that when he comes to visit me, I can't even give him a meal. And the third is the idiot outside who thinks I'm going to sleep with him just because I gave him he gave me a leg of his bushbuck.
What a wonderful story. Elizabeth, just very briefly, who's the book for? Because you're a prize-winning children's author. So
No. Grown-ups, please, grown-ups. Great. It's full of the frightfully, frightfully tricky stuff, you know, slashings off of penises, all kinds of exciting things.
That's the lure of the honeybird. Elizabeth Laird, thank you very much indeed.
From London.
To New York.
To Tokyo. To Buenos Aires.
To Zurich. Hong Kong,
to Toronto,
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv, to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And before we go, for our Brazilian newspaper review, let's listen to a track of an upcoming Brazilian singer who is coming to Europe soon for a tour. I think Monaco's Fernando Augusto Pacheco can explain what this song is about. Anyway, this is Thais Gullin with Cinema Big Butts. Because we're the average groupie. Prefiro os nossos sambistas. Prefiro o poeta pálido, anti-homem que ri que chora. Que lê Rambo Verlaine, que é frágil que te adora. Que entende o triunfo da poesia sobre o futebol. Mas que joga sua pelada todo domingo debaixo do sol. Prefere em vez de Slayer ouvir Caetano, ouvir Mano Tchau. Não quis ler, não seja legal. Vive será o ex-mão.
That was Cinema Big Butts by Thais Gullin. Sounds pretty good, actually.
Now we're joined in the studio by Monaco's researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who's got his Brazilian papers with him. But first, he needs to explain what this song was about. I don't know what to say about it.
Interesting title.
Quite an interesting song as well, because, you know, she's singing like with this kind of very suave Brazilian voice, you know, talking about love, and suddenly, I like big butts and I can't deny. So, why did she use this sample? Because she lived in the US when she was a kid and she used to hear the song all the time in the morning. And, you know, in Brazil has a certain obsession with butts. They don't need to be big. So I think it's kind of a mixture of everything. And in the end, it was perfectly weird, eccentric, lovely song.
So from the song and big butts to the news, and a pretty rare event in Brazil happened on Sunday. Tell us more about that, Fernando.
Exactly. I was very surprised myself because a tornado hit the city of Taquarituba, which is in the countryside of São Paulo. And 2 people died, 64 were hurt. Many people lost their houses as well. And that's very surprising because Brazilians used to proud themselves, oh, we don't have natural phenomenon here. We don't have volcanoes or tornadoes or heavy snow. But actually, tornadoes are becoming more and more common in Brazil. And I was reading Folha de São Paulo today, and one of the reasons apparently is because the country is becoming more urbanized. I didn't know there was a reason for tornadoes, but then apparently there is. So, and even people, because suddenly the tornado hit the city in just 5 minutes. A lot of people were surprised, like, what is that? You know, and the whole city was devastated.
Do you have a weather service then that predicts these sorts of things or not?
We don't. And actually, it was mentioned in the articles that actually Brazil needed that. But actually, apparently, you have to spend billions on that. And you know, it's quite expensive, especially when we're not that used to that, so it's not something that happens every day. It's not like in the US, for example. Mm.
Moving on to your next story, World Cup is indeed approaching, and there's interesting news for one of the stadiums now, so at least it won't be completely empty after the games.
Exactly. You know, we're talking here about Manaus, you know, because the World Cup is going to be in 9 different cities in Brazil, and Manaus is right at the Amazon. So there's not many people there, and 4 matches will be played there. And you know what's going to happen with the stadium after? It's going to become a prison. I think that's quite...
Gosh.
Unusual, you know, because they're spending 200 million euros on that.
Maybe they really need a prison.
Yeah, I don't think they do. I think it's one of those white elephants, you know, that Brazil's spending a lot of money in the World Cup, and in the end, those stadiums are not going to be used because, of course, in São Paulo and Rio, which are big cities, they're definitely going to be used. But in Manaus, to build such a big stadium just for four matches, I think that's quite weird. But it's going to be interesting to see a stadium becoming a prison.
Yes, imagine the Olympic Park, if that had become a prison. It's just quite a weird concept, isn't
it? Yeah, it's not a positive, because in a sport you think about nice things, positive, but a prison.
It's so often about gentrification, yeah. Even, and when you actually create a prison that doesn't actually take the area to that direction at all.
I don't like that.
Your next story, Fernando, please.
My next story is from O Globo newspaper. You know, it's the ongoing story about Mais Médicos, which is the government program to bring foreign doctors to the poorest areas of Brazil. There was a lot of controversy in this program, but in the end, actually, the majority of the population actually liked the idea, because the poorest cities in Brazil, they didn't have any doctors, because most doctors want to work in the big cities, because that's where they get paid more. But the problem is, more than 600 of them arrived in the country, but only 13% can actually practice, because it's another problem of Brazilian bureaucracy, which you need a register, and sometimes it can take weeks. So they're there in the country, ready to help, but they can't, you know. And you can even see a picture here, coming back to Folha de São Paulo. There's a Cuban doctor in the city of Pedreira, which she started already. She's one of the few who managed actually to start. And it's very weird because, for example, in the city of Queimada, in one of the units, they didn't have a doctor for 6 months, and they still can't practice just because of some...
So what kind of forms do they have to fill out? What do they have to do? What is the bureaucracy like?
It's incredible. I remember in Brazil we have places, for example, if you have an ID, you have to go to a place to get a copy of your ID with a stamp of approval. So your original ID is not enough. It's very weird.
And
I think we need to fix that.
How do you move forward with that? How do you get the doctors, you know, qualified to start practicing? Because there are clearly many people who need their help.
Exactly. I mean, they are on the process to do it. But, you know, as I said, it can take 2 to 3 months or even more. It's not a good thing.
Also, fighting Brazilian MPs is one story from you for this morning.
Surely not. MPs fighting.
Oh, wow. Well, yesterday this happened because we have a truth commission in Brazil, which is an investigation, to investigate crimes that happened during the dictatorship. And one of the I would say even far-right MPs, Jair Bolsonaro, he punched the far-left MP, Randolfo Rodrigues, because, you know, Jair Bolsonaro used to be part of this dictatorship. And in my opinion, he's one of the most distasteful MPs we have. He's very sexist, homophobic, you know, and apparently this Randolph kind of said something to him and he just punched him in the stomach. So that's another, yeah.
Will we see something similar happening at the UN General Assembly today?
Well, maybe Dilma will punch Obama because, you know, our relationship between Brazil and US is not very good at the moment. So today, actually, Dilma is going to give a speech at the UN to basically for the UN have some sort of global regulation for spying. And I don't think Obama will even mention that. But because, you know, Dilma had to cancel her state visit to the US because, even due to public pressure as well. I don't think Brazilians would like to see her in the US at this time.
Can you think of anything that would actually improve Brazilian-American relations now?
I don't know. I mean, I've been to New York recently. I think as a people, I think we're very close. I mean, we're the two biggest countries in the Americas. We have a lot of similarities. But political-wise, at the moment, is a very hard thing to tell you, Marcus. Yeah. So maybe just through music and fun.
Okay.
And cinema big butts.
Exactly. That was Monocle's researcher, Fernando August Pacheco. Thank you very much. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Denis, our researcher, Fernando August Pacheco, and Matt Alagaya, and Maddie Arouge. Our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Up next after the news is the Entrepreneurs Monocle's business program, which is this week hosted by Daniel Ciacopelli. And I will be back with Georgina Godwin for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Marcus Hippi.
And me, Victoria Graham. Thanks for listening. Goodbye. Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.